Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of May 18th. It's early and a little bit wet in this part of Tokyo on a Saturday morning. And with me is Jim Allen. How you doing, bud? I had to check. I had to look outside the window.
Oh, okay. Well, that was interesting because I haven't looked outside the window, so I was kind of amazed. I figured you went out for a run or something.
Not today. Actually, it was supposed to be raining, so I just I was in no run mode from the moment I went to sleep last night, so didn't even look outside much.
Well, as
long I'm good. I've got 50 kilometers in already this week, so I'm good.
Wow, I'm impressed. I'm just like, I can't do that stuff no more. But not like I ever could. But anyway, no, I'm fine. How you doing, man?
I am doing well, and as we've been doing each week, we thank again the healthcare workers, the essential workers, the sanitation workers, everybody. Keep up the fight. Sure. We appreciate you guys. Thank you very much.
Sure. Keep at it. Stay safe. Stay at home. Wear masks when you go out because it's about protecting other people.
That's right. All right. On this week's show, we've got an interview with former Rakuten infielder and utility player Rick Short, and we've got a glimpse of a flicker of light at the end of the tunnel for a possible partial season. That's a mouthful. We've got Jim's lingering trivia question from last week and a couple of notes and some fantastic high heat. So let's start swinging.
All right. So the other day, I had a chance to talk to some Arizona Diamondbacks coaches, and one of them was Rick Short. Now, Rick Short played in Japan for 5 seasons, and he had this career that was like, I don't know, cats have 9 lives. Well, Rick Short is now on his 6th baseball life. So we're going to talk about the 4 of the baseball lives of Rick Short. Now he's the coach, as I said, he's in AA with the hitting coach of the Generals, the Jackson Generals of Jackson, Tennessee, which is not, if you don't know much about Tennessee's geography, and I know some of you will, it's halfway between Memphis and Nashville. I had to look that up because I wasn't familiar with that. And it's not too far from his home in Illinois where he was when we spoke. Mm-hmm. Now, Rick was, I said, he was, I mentioned the lives of his baseball lives. He was like a minor leaguer forever. You know, it's like he had this amazingly long minor league career. And then he got a chance to come and play for the Marines where he did well. And then they changed managers and he got booted. And then he went back to the States where he was a minor leaguer again until in his second year back, he became a 32-year-old major league rookie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then at the end of the season, he's out of a job again. And then so he comes back and he's got this job with the Rakuten Eagles. And it's like he's 33 years old and he's in the prime of his career. Okay, now don't give me any guff about that. Well, I mean, it's not really the prime of his career, but it's his most successful baseball at an elite level. And we'll talk about that. He was a guy who was kind of out of time. He's a guy who, in my opinion, showed he could be was a really productive hitter. But basically he played, he missed his window because of his playing style, which was just a guy who's going to put the ball in play and draw a few walks. But he was really good at those two things. And so he had this just tremendous on-base percentage, and he had some drawbacks to his career, which we'll talk about, or drawbacks to his value. But basically he was finished in the minors by the time Moneyball was becoming a big thing and people were going, oh, on-base percentage, that's a thing, is it? So basically at the very end of his career was when, you know, the very end of his baseball life was really the highlight. So it's just a fascinating story about a guy's journey through baseball. And so let's just listen to Rick Short tell his story. Okay. Our guest on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is former Lotte Marine and Rakuten Eagles and former Pacific League batting champion, Rick Short. And, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate you having me.
Now, are you still the batting coach of the Jackson Generals?
Yeah. I'm actually in Double A with the Arizona Diamondbacks, and I actually, when I retired from playing, I got into scouting.
Okay.
And I scouted for 7 years, and then I always had the itch to get back on the field. So I approached the Diamondbacks about coaching, and they made a position for me, and I'm in my third year of coaching now, and I've gotten to the Double A level. So it's going well, and it's been awesome working with hitters and starting to get into some upper level baseball. So it's getting pretty cool.
Well, if your coaching career mimics your playing career, you might make it to the majors about the time you're 60.
Yeah, I hope to go a little bit faster than that. but no, it's been a long road. But, you know, it's kind of cool. I mean, I've seen the game from a bunch of different perspectives as a player, as a mm-hmm. scout, now as a coach. So definitely the foundation has been laid for a baseball education.
And yeah.
Hopefully I can just continue the path.
Yeah, well, that's we were chatting about before we get into the Japan stuff. You know, this was we were chatting about the what does a coach do mm-hmm. when everybody's quarantined and maybe – you know, this is an eye opener for a lot of us. We read, we're writers. We basically care about players. We're going like, a coach is like, are you still talking to me? I'm being mean, but,
yeah.
But I love talking to coaches because people aren't flocking to them and they have a lot of interesting things to say because, you know, they're not burned out talking to the media.
Right. No, so, it's definitely an interesting time. You know, we're just trying to get better as coaches, studying a lot of stuff because there's a lot of techniques nowadays, especially with hitting.
Mm.
So yeah, just kind of in the, you know, kind of a self-improvement mode right now and
okay.
just trying to keep up with all the technology and data and trying to stay engaged with the players. So it's been busy actually.
Now you said that there was also some connection with the other coaches in terms of like the staff meetings and or, you know, mm-hmm. communication and how is that working?
Yeah, so we're doing quite a few Zoom calls, conference calls, and we're doing we're breaking them up like the hitting coaches will get together, the pitching coaches will get together.
Oh, for all the different teams in the organization?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it's for all the different departments and stuff. So, it's been cool. I mean, you know, there's been other opportunities where like our mental skills department will get on it. It'll be like a leadership call.
Interesting.
And, you know, like, I guess just devising ways and thinking of ways to become a better teacher and connecting with players and, you know, basically trying to develop as many big leaguers as we possibly can.
Yep. Okay. Well, this is the thing is talk about people, you know, getting to the major leagues. Of course, it's not just about getting to the major leagues, but, you know, being, as you said, being a better player. Now, you were you were drafted in the 33rd round.
Mm-hmm.
And you, as I saw in Baseball Reference, you were the only player in that round, in that year, to make it to the major leagues.
Yeah, I definitely beat the system, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I can think. But here's the thing, okay, your career was basically high on base percentage, corner infielder, corner outfielder, utility guy. Maybe if you were a left-handed hitter, you would have gotten more chances.
Yeah, I think that's probably an accurate statement. You know, like I said, I got into scouting after I got done playing, so it was a chance to kind of evaluate myself, in my career. And I guess I'd probably have more value if I was a left-handed hitter, and also if I played somewhere in the middle of the field, like shortstop or center field.
Right.
But you know, unfortunately, I was a corner guy. I was a third baseman, left fielder. I didn't play a lot of shortstop. I played first and second, but.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the power numbers were a little bit lower, but the averages were always higher and the on base was higher. And, I guess maybe I would have been a valuable player maybe in the 80s.
Yeah.
But the era that I came through, it was all about power. And, so I guess I just missed the window.
Yeah. But the other one is, of course, and if you come along a little later too, then people are saying, oh, geez, this guy's got, you know, 400 on-base percentages every year. Maybe we can find a place for him.
Yeah, no, I think, right, super utility role is becoming pretty popular
right.
nowadays, and it's you know, it's always valuable to have that type of guy on a roster because of the versatility, and you know, managers have flexibility of lineups and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the game, although it doesn't look like it to the fans, that has changed very much. It has changed a lot in the way rosters are constructed, and you know, with the value of players.
Okay, so now you're basically in. I'm going to go back a little bit. So 2003, you're 30 years old. You're coming out for your 30-year-old season, and you're going to Japan for the Lotte Marines. And you had been, I guess, in AAA the year before. You finished with the Angels?
Mm-hmm. I did. 2002, I was with the Angels.
Okay.
Which was actually the year that they won the World Series.
Okay.
And I had a really good year in AAA. I ended up winning the Pacific Coast League batting title that year. And I was really hoping I could have at least gotten a call-up. Because you know, as we know now, I would have had a World Series ring, but I did not call up. So yeah, I went looking for other opportunities, and they extended an offer. It's a great opportunity.
Now, when you get to camp, you know, I guess you guys were in Kagoshima then, and there's another guy there who had been playing in Japan, and he just came back, and he started his career in Japan as a second baseman coming out of the Angels organization. He was coming out of AAA with the Angels. He had played with the Angels a bit, but and that's Bobby Rose.
Yeah.
And did you ever did you have any conversations with him about what it took to be in Japan?
I didn't really get to know Bobby that well. I mean, we spent a little time together in spring training. It was weird how it worked out, because you know, you look at the players that we had with that Lotte team, and I think there was probably four foreigners, and you know, I might have been maybe the odd man out, and maybe would have had to start the year in the minor leagues, but Bobby ended up making the decision that he was going to retire, which kind of opened a spot for me on the opening day roster. So, I mean, Bobby made his decision, and it actually kind of worked out for me. But, you know, I did hear a lot about his career, and, I mean, he did great things over there, so I had a lot of respect for him.
Well, we had him on the show recently, and I asked him about that. What made you think you'd want to do a Japanese spring training after not playing 2 years of baseball? He says, I was living in Colorado at the time, and I probably wasn't getting enough oxygen for my brain.
Yeah. I don't know if he was all in on it when he was there, but, you know, he seemed like a good guy. I didn't get to spend a lot of time with him, but we did have some conversations. They were pretty good.
Well, that kind of interested me because you came up and you and Jose Fernandez had were very productive, I remember, for the Marines in 2003. And then you're 31 and you're out of a job, and you know, this is your second chance. You know, this Japan's the second chance, and you're and now you're 31 and you have a respectable season, and now you're out of work again. So that's like, wow, that was a short second chance.
Yeah, it was a little tough because, like you said, I thought I had a pretty successful year. I guess the Marines were in the midst of a change, and I don't think it was part of the plan. So, yeah, I was kind of, again, the odd man out, and they brought me back to the United States again. And like you said, trying to drum up some more work and trying to find an opportunity. So,
I mean, that was
kind of a tough place to be in.
Yeah, that was. I mean, now tell me, was it? But you still played, 129 games that year in AAA, and for Edmonton and Omaha, and I mean, typical AAA, I mean, season for you in the sense that, you know, you finished within the Expos organization, .378 on base percentage. And so I guess that was an opportunity. Somebody looked at it as an opportunity to keep you.
Yeah, it was. I actually started the year with Kansas City.
Right.
And I ended up getting traded halfway through the year in a minor league trade, which brought me to the Expos at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good opportunity because, as we all know, the next year they became the Washington Nationals,
right.
And you know, it was a chance. It was an organization that was just getting going, and it was a chance to, you know, maybe just you know, my value as a player, maybe they would and that's exactly what happened. So it was a good opportunity.
Yeah. So, and then you had that just amazing year in New Orleans. And so you got a chance to play. I mean, just eye popping stuff. I mean, eye popping, but only in the sense that it was certainly within the range of what you'd been doing all along.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I think I had always had good years, but it had to be something ridiculous to get organizations' attention, and that's kind of what 2005 was. I was over 400 with, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks to go in the season. It actually caught national attention, and I had a couple of call ups during that year, my first time up, and yeah. So it was cool, but it did. It took something absolutely ridiculous to get the attention of people and to get that opportunity. So that's kind of what 2005 was for me.
Okay, so you got to play in the majors. So you're one of these guys who basically you had your second chance in Japan, and I'm thinking there's a few players who went back and they made their major league debuts after coming to Japan, and you're one of them. And then you... although most of them aren't 32 when it happens, and most of them do longer than 1 year in Japan, you know, before the manager decides to clean house and bring in his other guys. And well, we're friends. So I'm not gonna go down that road too much.
So that
really bizarre 2005 season, and then I guess you get a call from the Rocktown Eagles.
So. After I left Lotte, I played in Japan. I wanted to keep playing over there. Mm-hmm. And like you said, there was no opportunity. So it actually worked out well. I came back, played in the big leagues, fulfilled that dream. And then I always wanted to come back to Japan. And then Rakuten actually had an opportunity.
Yeah.
And they extended an offer. And I looked at it as a chance to go back to where I wanted to go back to. And that's exactly what I did. I jumped on it and never looked back.
Yeah, so they made a couple of changes that year. That was their second year, and you're there with Jose Fernandez again.
Yeah,
and it's not like you two. It's like what's going on here? It's like connected at the hip or something.
Yeah, it was actually really nice because it was a familiar face, and I obviously played in Chiba together, and mm-hmm. it was a chance to play together again, and so it was kind of nice to have a familiar face there.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, and I was so psyched when I saw him in December. It was like, whoa! And also a great friend of the podcast. And so anyway, so tell us about, first of all, I'm watching your video from when you were with mm-hmm. the Eagles, and I just thought, damn, that... You just have a swing that kind of plays everywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It actually was a very simple swing. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm a hitting coach, I can probably break myself down a little bit. But it was a very simple swing. It was a very repeatable swing. It was a little bit challenging playing in Japan because I don't know stereotypically if I was the type of player that gets a lot of opportunities over there. Usually it's the power guys.
Right.
And I wasn't the 30 home run a year guy.
Yeah.
So I really kind of had to stay true to who I was.
Right.
That was pretty much, just a consistent hard contact, gap to gap hitter with a lot of doubles and
mm-hmm.
Like you said, high on base percentage and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So yeah. So I didn't really try to be anybody that I wasn't, and I just stuck to who I was, and I had a pretty good run, I thought.
Now, your manager for the 4 years in Rakuten Sendai was Katsuya Nomura. Now, what was that like? Was there much interaction with him?
Because
he was kind of the curmudgeon, cool, curmudgeon with the capital C sometimes.
Yeah. He was, there wasn't much of a relationship there.
Okay.
I mean, he was always really... it was nice to me. We didn't talk a lot, but mm-hmm. He put me in the lineup every day, which I appreciated.
Okay.
And I played hard for him, so it was kind of, I'd probably say, a more professional relationship.
Okay.
I had a lot of respect for what he had done in his career and who he was in Japanese baseball, and it was pretty cool.
Well, I've heard I guess that's probably the ultimate comment is that, you know, he played every day and he didn't criticize you too much because one of his biggest players he developed said, if he doesn't get angry at you, it means you're not worth his time.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, that's kind of how he was. I think I can count the conversations probably on one hand that we had in my time playing with him. And it was usually about food or a restaurant or something. But yeah, other than that, it was pretty straightforward. Go out and produce and play hard, and that was it.
Well, tell me a little bit about that experience jumping to Japan, because like I said, you know, you started what you did when you were 31, and then you came back and a couple of years later, and you played what, 5 years in Sendai?
Yeah, I did four Sendai, years. One Chiba, five total.
Okay,
yeah.
So 4 years in Sendai. I mean, so your first chance, your second chance in Japan didn't last, and your third chance in America got you to the majors for 11 games or so, and your fourth chance, that turned out to be the charm. Fourth time was the charm, I suppose.
Yeah. No, I had a chance to play every day in Rakuten and just kind of settle in. And like you said, I had already been to Japan, so I kind of knew what to expect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew what I needed to do as a player and as a hitter to be successful over there. And a lot of times I think when hitters go over there, they're very reluctant to change because they've had success. But in reality, I mean, the pitching in Japan is I mean, they're good. I mean, they command their off-speed stuff and they pitch off their off-speed stuff, where over in the States it's more velocity based and jumping on fastballs. And, you know, over there it's, you kind of just got to use the middle of the field, and you know, sometimes you kind of got to not take a two strike approach, but you kind of got to give in a little bit sometimes because you know, like I said, they can command their secondary pitches, and I think that's kind of what I did well. You know, making that adjustment, and I knew that going in my second time that's what it was.
Okay, so you were really well prepared. Now, your job as a hitting coach is to prepare hitters to be ready, you know, not just for the guy they're facing today, who may or may not have something, but, you know, the people they're going to be able to face, you know, give them the skills they can face in the future. So let me ask, did you take anything from Japan that helped you as a hitting coach?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, actually, like when I was talking about how, you know, staying true to who I was and not changing, not trying to be something, you know, that's probably something that I would preach to hitters, you know, from now until the end of time, you know. And like I said, like using the middle of the field was huge for me in Japan. And I always think that's a great approach with hitters. It's amazing how many slumps end with just a simple thought of getting back to the middle of the field. And yeah, so I really think, you know, when I went over to Japan, that's when I was really starting to hit my stride as a hitter. That's when I really learned how to hit, because I think the pitching over there was so crafty, and, you know, like I said, they command the ball well. And yeah, so it taught me a lot about hitting, and hopefully I can pass that along to some guys.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now as you were mentioning earlier about the, you know, the technology and the techniques and, here's the thing. I tend to talk to more and more old guys. I'm not talking about the guy we had on the other week, Carter Stewart Jr., but the older guys who are like looking at the shifts, and they're looking at the launch angle, and they're going, what the heck has happened to my game? You know, they're the old guy in The Simpsons, you know, shouting at the clouds a little bit, because there's not a lot, you know, you can't change, you come to Japan, you can't change the way they play the baseball. But when there's a hitter like you, who is a guy basically just trying to use the field and have a nice compact swing, and somebody saying, oh, no, two strikes, what two strikes? I'm launching this puppy.
Yeah. It's like you said, I mean, there's so many resources nowadays. It's a completely different animal than when I was playing. And I think one of the challenges that, you know, or at least one of the things that we need to remember is in player development, I think the the curve is probably a little steeper with development, because if you think about it, all of these guys' weaknesses are exposed now. It's all in a database. I mean, and all the teams have data, and you know, it's and that was another thing challenging in Japan is, you know, I mean, you played the same teams quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I mean, they knew you like back and forth.
Right.
And so it was pretty tough to hit over there, but getting back to what I was saying, it's like all these guys' weaknesses are documented now, and you know it's, there's no hiding, you know. It's a tough game now, and I think we need to keep that in mind with player development, that it might take some time. These guys might struggle a little bit, because, you know, the days of like a prospect tearing up, you know, and just like skyrocketing into the big leagues, it's few and far between. I mean, it's data driven. There's a lot of shifts. They know where you hit the ball. They know exactly where to pitch you, and it's tough. It is tough.
Yeah. I mean, and again, the other thing is, that talking to coaches and again, because I talked to older guys, somebody who played in Japan, so many now are coaches, that if you were in Japan, you know, if you're a coach in Japan, you'd be saying, this is how you play. This is how you hit. You know, this is how, not, and I mean you in the general sense, like everybody,
right,
everybody in the world, this is how you hit. And I'm
right.
You're an individual, take that individual stuff and find a closet for it or something. But in America, it's a different, also a different animal, because you've got a, you know, it's player driven. The coaching is so player driven. So
it is player driven, and you know, connecting with the players and the language that they speak is kind of changing over time. So it is our jobs as we get older, like you said, to kind of stay in tune with what they're seeking out and what they're being exposed to. And you know, the social media aspect of it, and they're on, you know, they're on Twitter and they're finding, you know, all kinds of hitting stuff. And, you know, it's whatever you tell a hitter, they're going to go and they're going to research it in a thousand different places, and they're going to see if you're right or not. So there's some pressure.
And they're going to see that 100 people disagree with you.
Some of whom
might actually know what they're talking about.
You're exactly right, and you know, we do fight that on a daily basis. So, you know, it's pretty in vogue nowadays for guys to have their own personal hitting coaches, and then, you know, they show up in spring training, and you know, you almost, as you know, as a hitting coach in the organization, you're almost playing catch up, because it's like, okay, what have you been working on, and who you've been working with, and you know, so yeah, it is hard. It's a lot to keep track of, for sure.
Certainly, so there's another level to the ordinary, and another level to it, but also I would suppose that makes the personal relationship so much more important. That
100%, and that's always going to be probably the most important part of coaching. And I think you can probably invent whatever technology, whatever data you want to implement into the game, but connecting with players and those daily conversations will never go away.
Yeah, that seems really the key. And so when we were talking about, you know, the keeping in touch with the players and keeping on top of the skills and learning the language, I mean, those are all the tools that you know, probably get you back to the majors before you're 16.
I'm going to tell you what, it's more studying than I ever thought it would be, and that's okay. I mean, we're always like looking for a better way to do things, but it's a challenge, man. It's a challenge, but it's one that I welcome, and I love every minute. I enjoy doing it.
Wonderful. Now let's see. You're back living in Illinois. Is it? You're from Illinois.
Yeah, from the Chicago area, and then my wife and I met at school at Western Illinois, and we've been married 25 years now, so.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, still in Illinois.
All right. Well, hopefully it won't take us this long to get back to you. We have trouble with our keeping up with our coaches, because they're busy. I mean, they're busy during the year. So this year we've got this little window, and we're exploiting it probably more than we should.
Yeah, I think our busy times kind of probably match each other. We're on the same schedule. So I've enjoyed this, catching up. This is great.
Okay, you take care, man.
Thanks for the call, man. You too.
Yeah, if I have other questions, I know where to get you. I can reach out and get your email and Facebook and whatever.
Awesome, man. Anytime.
Okay, I really appreciate it, and just best of luck keeping up with the times. I know you'll be on it.
I appreciate it, Jim. Best of luck to you too.
Okay, take care, bud.
Okay, thank you, Rick Short. Jeez, that was a long time coming.
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to get Shorty. Ha ha ha.
Oh, good one. Yeah, nice Elmore Leonard reference there, John.
Okay. I just saw the movie, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to get him. I recall sitting down with Rick one day. It must have been, let me say, 2007.
Okay.
In the preseason, and we were sitting in the stands for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe he just wasn't playing that particular game. And I just remember us in the stands, and we were talking about what kind of player would be a successful player in Japan if he were maybe scouting or something. I don't know why we were talking about this. I don't know how we got on this topic, but you know, he was talking about guys. I would bring over guys with a really good two-strike approach in the States. And if they were having that success there, it means that they're thinking their way through the game, blah, 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 blah. And I remember thinking or walking away from that conversation saying, one day he's going to make a really good manager/coach. And here he is as a coach. So I'm just going to focus on a few points. But, I loved the Katsuya Nomura portion and hearing about, you know, Nomo-san just probably disrespecting him enough and knowing what kind of player he was and what he was going to get each day just to leave him alone.
Yeah, I suspect if he was a Japanese guy, he probably couldn't leave him alone because Nomura was like, he had an itch to egg people on about things, even the guys he really liked. You know, he just kind of couldn't, he had a needle. You know, he carried a needle around with him and he used it to needle people.
Poke people, yeah. And I like the part Rick talked about him staying within himself or being true to himself and those part, because I think a lot of the players who were coming over at that time were just guys who were power guys like he talked about. And that was kind of, you're right. He's like either he was in a time warp, and he was either before his time or after his time, one or the other. maybe baseball can be cyclical as well. So maybe he just got in the cycle he stepped in at the offbeat on the
upbeat. Yeah, he needed a time machine. Beat. So more than anybody in baseball.
Yeah. And that was one of the things I was thinking when he was talking. I hate the fact that MLB labels defensive positions. Like, that guy's a corner outfielder. We need him to hit for power. I mean, to me, it doesn't really, you know, whoever hits for power, hits for power. Don't worry about where they play defensively. But I want to focus on an aspect that sent up alerts for me. And that's the private coach situation that he talked about. Because remember when I went back to the States in 2003 and 2004?
Etched in my memory.
Right. I was covering some high school sports at that time, and I remember talking to some of the high school coaches at that time who were expressing a lot of frustration because they had travel teams, travel softball, travel baseball teams, and a lot of the players who were really good, maybe I would say elite travel players, had personal coaches. And that made it very difficult for these high school coaches and youth coaches to actually get the players to do what they wanted because they had private coaches telling them what to do. And so it harkened me back to the time, I don't know if you recall, but Jose Lopez, when he was with the Giants, had a guy, and I don't know if the guy was a relative or a friend. I'm not sure if you remember the guy, but he would come over and critique Jose's at bats. Do you remember that guy?
I do not. I don't even remember that story.
And so one time, this friend, I think it was a relative, maybe by marriage or something, but he was a baseball guy. It wasn't just that, he was like a coach. And he shared some of his observations of Jose's at bats with me. And he said, well, for example, this bat, he went up there with no plan. And he took some bad swings and he wasn't thinking through this, that, and the other. And so I know these private coach situations can be a problem in maybe not the major league level, but once you get to this level, like, you know, to have a guy like Jose Lopez, and of course he was with the Giants at the time, and now he has a manager with whom he can converse in his native language and get as many batting tips as anybody. And I don't know if that guy is still there or still with him, but it just reminded me of that situation that, you know, here's a foreign player who's very successful here in Japan, and he still has a guy coming to help him out with his at-bats. And that, I don't know what the relationship was with the team and, you know, the dynamic among those three entities, the coach, the player, and the team. I have no idea, but it just reminded me of that guy. And I wish I could remember his name. Maybe one day I'll ask Jose again.
Good luck with an answer on that one.
No, I'm sure he'll tell me, because I'll ask him. I mean, he'll tell me. I don't know. I don't think it's a bad thing. But it just reminded me of that, because, you know, you hear Rick talk about his knowing his weaknesses and knowing his swing and just being a very heady guy. And that's the other thing I wanted to talk about is what he said. You said he was drafted in the 33rd round.
Yep.
And he was the only one in that round to actually play in the big leagues.
All of 15 games.
Yeah, not that much, but he made it there. And that was my thing that I mentioned in the PL prediction special, which is, you know, it doesn't really matter where you get drafted, because some guys just have a higher profile. And the reason I always say that is because for me, again, it's always about me, right? It's a story about me. But when I was in college, I played in a racquetball tournament, and as I was going into my first round match, there were two guys, and I went to school in Orange County, Cal State Fullerton. Not a lot of people with a darker hue to their skin tone. And so right in front of me, this guy is going to go in for his match, and his friend comes up, and right in front of me, he just says, "Oh man, just win, baby." Like I wasn't even standing there. And the thing was, I wasn't, you know, they ranked everybody because based on what you had done in the past. Now, I just didn't have a resume that they had any information on. So I go in, I beat the pants off of this guy, and he comes in, and his friend is like pumping his fist and like, "You won, right?" And he says, "No, man, the guy killed me." And they just devalued me because they didn't know I could play because I had no profile. And that's what happens when you get in. Whether you have a Koshien situation where you're playing in the National High School Baseball Tournament, you get a lot of TV time. Whether you have a profile or not, it just matters whether or not you can play. And Rick Short, you talked about his swing, and you said his swing plays here. It could play in the States. It could play anywhere because he had a good swing. It didn't matter what his profile was or what his resume said. When you get on the field, it just matters whether you can play or not. And this guy, he's a really heady guy, and I think that was part of his success, and that a lot of times gets undervalued because, you know, you can be really, really smart but not be able to play. So he had both. He actually had a ability and the smarts, and it was just really a fun conversation.
Yeah, well, obviously he's really intuitive about things, and I was quite interested to hear him talk about breaking down his hitting performance as a scout in his fifth life in pro baseball. Okay, well, you know, that reminds me, because sometimes, you know, you mentioned typecast, and I have to think back, and I'll digress early. Get started early. It's early in the morning. I'm going to digress early. John Zuber was a big guy, a first baseman, who played 1 year for the Yokohama Bay Stars in 2001. And basically the story in Japan was his manager, Masaaki Mori, the Hall of Fame manager and longtime catcher for the Omiri Giants and Hall of Fame manager of the Lions, said, you know, I looked at the video. This guy's a big guy. I love his stroke. He's going to crush in Japan.
Well, crush the crusher.
Exactly. You know, wear a mask, get him in the ring. It's the crusher. So John Zuber came over, and you got a name like Zuber and it's going to be perfect. And it's like, he's a guy, when I look back I don't remember exactly, but it seemed like he had his career high was like 10 home runs in the minors. And he said that was mostly luck. But this is a guy.
No, you hate to hear that.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, he was saying just everything came together and I hit 10 home runs, you know? So I'm going like, so what kind of a hitter is it? And my eyes lit up, because I've been writing analytic guides to Japanese baseball for 4 years in the 90s. And here was a guy who just like stung everything and drew walks. He was basically a 300 hitter a guy who could hit 300, you know, coming out of bed at 4 a.m. and would draw, you know, 80 walks a season. So we're talking about a 400 plus on base percentage. And basically the Bay Stars were upset that he wasn't the power hitter they thought he was. And everybody loved John. He was a really popular teammate, and the people who played with him here at the time were thinking, well, you know, what a great guy. This guy's just going to have his great career in Japan. And it was like, sorry, you don't meet our expectations. Like, get out of here. Who brought you here? Who said you were
right? Good?
So anyway, Rick Short had that kind of...
You promised us a power hitter.
Yeah. Well, I promised people you were going to be a power hitter. And you are making a liar out of me. And that happens so often in baseball, you know, because people have to make decisions about talent. And very often the decision is not matching what the talent is. But what Rick Short said about being true to yourself is so important, because there's always people who are going to tell you what's best for you. And even people who know you, and, you know, and I want to be like this kind of hitter. And I want to be like that kind of hitter. These are skills I can develop. And, but you know, players will tell you, you know, you got to go with what works and go, you can try this and try that, but you got to go with what works. And it's very easy to get away from what works when you're in a situation in Japan where people are 100 people are telling you what you should be as opposed to what you are. It's hard enough in the minors. So, but my question regarding to that with Rick Short was thinking about, okay, here's a guy who knows about making contact, and he knows about that, you know, the small, that element of the game, making good contact and getting, as he said, getting out of slumps, basically. You know, it's a very human focus, I thought, as opposed to, you should launch the ball. You should learn to put backspin in launch angle. You know?
Right. And I remember we got a question from Dragon Song. I think it maybe was earlier this year or late last year. And he was asking about perhaps launch angle being implemented in with the Dragons and Alonzo Powell. And I said, yeah, well, his answer basically was that, or Alonzo's answer to the question was basically, these guys have to learn to hit first. They have to learn to actually make contact and think their way through the game before you teach them those technical things about changing swings and all that stuff. So you hear about Rick, and he might have been in his position because he was a really good contact guy, but he knew his limitations, or he knew his style.
Yeah, he knew what worked with him, for him.
What worked, and right, and he didn't try to change that. He didn't jump over to the launch angle situation. Not that it was, I'm sure it was a thing, even that early on, or at that time, but I think that was for different kinds of hitters. And
it's always for different kinds of hitters, because every hitter is everybody's body and that combination of body and brain and physical skills is unique.
Exactly. And by the way, Rick is another player who did that hop, skip, jump between NPB and the big leagues that we spoke of.
Well, hop, skip, jump between America and the big leagues, because he
He started. He didn't make it to the big leagues first, and he came
he missed
here.
That, but missed that he was a September call up from doing it. He's a little bit like Tony Barnett. In the sense that, imagine Tony Barnett had his career in the major leagues and then said, I'm going back to Japan for 4 more years.
Right.
Yeah, no. Okay.
Yeah, no.
So anyway, so there was that, and I was thinking about that. And the other thing I would want to add is that one thing he mentioned was really an eye-opener for me. I mean, there were a number of things that were eye-opening for me, but I'll leave them because, you know, he explained them very well, is how can Japanese baseball be so hard, you know, aside from the one which I focus on a lot, which is cultural distractions, you know, the manager telling you, you know, something that makes bad coaches and managers speaking in what are to you non sequiturs, and things going on outside the lines, which are distracting because they're so radically different from your life experience. So those things I talk about a lot, you know, putting those aside and accepting the fact that you're in Japan and going with the program to a certain degree that you can be part of the team, like Carter Stewart talked about. But something we talk about a lot with pitchers and hitters, but we don't really, nobody comes out and says it so, said it as well as Rick Short did, or at least in my memory, which is, you know, granted, I'm ancient, so my memory is not as good as it once was.
Right.
Which is, he said, you know, they know you in Japan. And well, he was talking about the minor leaguers. He was saying it's hard now for minor league, it's harder now for hitters to succeed in the minors because the data available on minor league opponents is so good now.
Right. Yeah.
And I would think that actually, that also goes to the majors, because it used to be people said, look, there's 30 teams. You know, you can't know the 29 different teams that you might play in a season. So you just got to go up there, see the ball, hit the ball. But now they're like going, oh, no, I got this guy's video. I'm looking at the guy's video. And I played him last year, so I'm good. You know, I'm prepared. I see what he's doing this year. I see what he's trying to do. You can prepare for guys the way you couldn't never prepare for them before, unless they were in your division or in, as they say in Japan, you know, you play them 25 games a year, so you know everybody. I mean, that's an overstatement. But it hadn't occurred to me that that is one area where Japan, you know, because people say, you know, how can Japan be hard? You know, I heard Adam Jones on his podcast the other day, you know, Japanese baseball is not easy. And of course, Zach Neale said, baseball's not easy, period. We had that discussion. You know, if you go to single A thinking you're going to kill it and you don't take it seriously, it will kill you pretty much regardless of how good you are. It's really hard to, and that's, that of course goes, you know, Barry Bonds could probably still crush minor league, you know, minor league baseballs. Not played for 10 years because his talent level is so elite. But the point is that when you come to Japan, there's an extra layer of you know, they add an extra layer of complexity to the game with that, or at least they used to, with that ability to know what you were doing, not because the data was so good, but because there are only five opposing teams in the league.
Right. And he said, they know you, they know everything about you. And pitchers are trying to, you know, they pitch to your weaknesses and they try to get you out. And I mean, a lot of times if you look at the heat maps, traditionally, I've been collecting them since, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. So I try to look at the same players every year and see where the heat maps have changed. But, you know, the more versatile a hitter, the guys who can handle the slider down and away and the fastball down and away and whatever their weak point is in the zone, those are the guys who are going to have success because they're the ones who they're just versatile enough to cover all those zones. Because if you have a weakness in Japan, I think it was Dr. Gail Hopkins talked about it before. You have a weakness, they're going to find it. And they're going to pound you.
Right. And I think that is so true. And, you know, and people say, of course, detractors come. And I think there are detractors to the amount of, you know, the too much information. You know, you're getting, you know, information overload. It's easy in Japan because they'll give you a
paralysis analysis.
Exactly. They give you a sheaf of papers. You know, we've got a two-game interleague series, and here's a 40-page report.
You know, poor tree.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly. We cut down a tree for this game. So, but that there was that. But on the other hand, there's also, you know, they have all this to get back to the point. The other thing that Rick said, which I really enjoyed, was the bit about knowing the players and how hard it is to develop minor league players now with all the data going around. And that reminded me so much of Japan. And what that was interesting to me was that people ask, how can it be hard in Japan? Because the pitchers don't throw, you know, 100 miles an hour consistently. The hitters are not, you don't have as many guys who can hit the ball 500 feet. How can Japan possibly be so hard? Okay, of course, one side is, you know, is the Zach Neal argument that baseball is hard, and if you don't respect it, it will, you know, take your lunch money.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side is that Japan has always been a small, the fewer number of teams always allowed Japanese teams to dig into the data and prepare to the nth degree, something that was not possible in a 30-team major league,
mm-hmm.
something that was not possible in the minors. So if you came to Japan, you know, they would, as you said, they're going to find what you're not good at. And that was a new experience for a lot of players. So, you know, Japan's hard like that. And that was something that Rick said that I think was really an eye-opener for me, because I was not ready for that. You know, we talked around it and talked about it. But to me, that was really interesting. You know, that's one reason Japan is hard, in addition to just baseball being hard. And in addition to the pitchers having, you know, excellent command of their secondary pitches and the batters being able to make contact. It's hard because they really know who you are.
Yes, yes. And you see them so often, as you said, yes.
Yeah. So I just was intrigued by that, and that opened a whole other can of worms.
Well, yeah, well, let's put them back. And it was a really fun conversation. Really enjoyed it. Thank you for doing the chat. And Shorty, I look forward to talking to you again and perhaps seeing you over here again. So thank you very much. All right, making a four-seam transition, we've got scheduling happening. So this past week, NPV got together with the J-League again and on its own and decided on June 19th to get back to something resembling a possible season. I'm not sure if the date is feasible. I think it's a strong target date. It's a good starting point, and I can see an actual start date in early July, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said earlier, a glimpse of a flicker of light at the end of the tunnel, perhaps.
Sorry, I'm laughing.
So, by the way, they canceled the All-Star Game Series, which is the first time since 1951.
When it started, yeah.
First time ever. And I'm assuming this, I think they said the CLCS and PLCS are likely out anyway.
Yep.
So we're not looking at playoff series before the Japan series would start. If they can get it going. So the schedule I saw in the TV report was they were looking to get practices going this week. And I'm not sure if that's a daily practice or a 5-day a week practice or 6-day a week practice, but that was the schedule that I saw. So what did you think when you heard this news? I know you posted and you tweeted about it. And
well, one is that they're talking about 120 games if they can start in June and 100 games, and roughly 100 games if they start in July. With, mm-hmm. as you said, no pre-Japan series, none of that Climax series stuff where they've been using to the top three teams in the league fight it out to see who plays in the Japan series. So that'll be gone. As far as having practices, I did see yesterday that the Hiroshima Carp are actually talking about having their whole team on the field.
Yes, I did see that report.
But they're the only team I've seen that with, because they're the only team that sent the Eagles in Sendai and the Hiroshima Carp are the only two teams whose home parks are outside of the state of emergency now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is still in a state of emergency. So that is, I can't even see teams practicing on the field together until
practice as we know it, as we've come.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they have been on the field. They have been, some of the teams were not even allowed to use their home stadiums during the state of emergency, but basically players have been practicing in small numbers and not even together. So
rotations. Yes.
Exactly. You know, so there'd be four players at the ballpark, but only one's allowed in the weight room at one time. Two are allowed in the indoor facility. Two are allowed on the field. I'm quoting from the Marines, because the Marines have been publishing their practice limitations. So, but the players are now, I saw that players are now, the Giants players are now taking practice at Tokyo Dome, which is new. they hadn't been. I'm sure they were socially distancing at Kawasaki until now, and now they're socially distancing at Tokyo Dome. But the Eagles opened practice. I saw that last week. The Eagles opened practice at Rock 10 Seimei Park in Sendai, and they had a lot of news about that. The guys were back onto their field and on, you know, standing in the dirt in their batter's box and throwing from their bullpen mounds and, you know, doing fielding practice on the mound, and they were really overjoyed. So I was glad to see that. I still don't think the season's going to start before July just because of all the difficulties of getting things together. But yeah.
I'm with you. I had the same feeling that, yeah, it's a good target date. June 19th is a good target date. Let's look at July to actually start.
Yeah.
100 games sounds really good to me. We have a high heat question about that, so we won't get into those details until we get to that part of the question or that part of the show. But my fears early on were that we weren't going to have anything, and I'd rather have something than nothing. So there are a lot of positive signs. We had fewer infections in Tokyo than we've had. And this was confirmed infections yesterday, which was Friday, fewer than we've had since back in March. So that's a good sign. That's just Tokyo, but that could be reflective of, in some ways, it's probably better that the number was so low here in Tokyo, where it is so crowded as opposed to other cities and other cities where automobiles are the main means of transportation, like Nagoya, Fukuoka.
We're not back anywhere, and I'm still concerned, but I'm hopeful that this is a sign. I think it's a sign that people are taking it more seriously rather than the sign that the infection is actually not a threat. But I think it's a case of just people taking it more seriously than they had. And Japan took it fairly seriously to begin with. I mean, at least individuals did, but
that's true.
But I do see ramped up. I mean, I do see more people wearing masks to protect their fellow citizens from the possibility that they might be infected without knowing it. And I'm very heartened by that. There's people still don't see or don't seem to care, but, you know, what can you do about them except be neurotic about it like I am?
Right. Yeah. Well, I can tell you this, have been a runner for a long time. I've never seen so many people out running on the streets because all the gyms are closed.
And I'll tell you, when I see somebody 3 weeks ago when I was shuttered at home, or a month ago, my wife and I would go out for daily walks near the river. And pretty much at that time, 4 weeks ago, about one-tenth of the runners were wearing masks. It's really hard to run with a mask on. It's just excruciating. And I understand that. But people were doing it. But most people weren't. And now I'd say it's about 80% of the people running have got masks on. And I just, my heart goes out to those people for doing their part, because that's like, I'm going to jab a fork in my foot for the sake of mankind kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it's actually not that bad right now. I can speak from experience, and thank you very much, but because I'm wearing a mask. In fact, I went out with a bandana the other day, and I just about choked myself because I got soaked with sweat, and it started to be part of the inhale process.
Oh, and you were waterboarding yourself. Dick Cheney would have been so proud, a person of color, self-waterboarding.
Yeah, so I'm going to order a visor over
face shield.
Amazon or something, and then I'm also going to use the mask. But the hotter it gets, the more difficult. But look, it's been fine. I haven't had that much trouble. It's not hot yet. I think that the summer months will really be the test. But to get off of that, because we don't want to talk about ourselves too much, let's make a seamless transition and talk about what this whole schedule thing is going to do to the draft. And we made mention of it last week on the show, and I said this whole shifting of the schedules, cancellations of the high school tournament, and by the way, the summer high school tournament is probably going to be canceled. We already saw the spring event canceled earlier this year, and so I was thinking about the corporate leagues, the indie leagues, and all these things last week when I mentioned the fact that these teams are going to have to still have a draft in October, because these kids, I'm assuming, or the high school kids are going to graduate, the college kids are going to graduate, and the corporate league guys are out there. So as we look, I know they're there tends to be a challenge to find the talent anyway without seeing some of the so-called cream rising to the top when you see the Cochin tournament. But this year will really, really be a challenge. I think as maybe in the draft, the rounds either go shorter because, as some people know, the draft goes until no team selects any player.
Or 120 players have been selected, period.
Or 120 players have been selected. So I could see the draft being shorter than usual. I could see it going longer because people just want, teams just want to take more players to make sure they haven't missed a diamond in the rough, perhaps. So that'll be intriguing to see. But how these teams go about collecting information without seeing the players play and seeing the growth from one year to the next is really going to be a challenge, in my opinion.
It is going to be hard because the spring tournament, high school tournament, was canceled. None of the corporate league teams are out playing. None of the college teams are playing. So it's really hard to see what people have been doing in the off season and, you know, over the winter and so on. So it's really hard. Most of the teams have made up their decisions basically by August 1st, before the Cochin tournament. So that cancellation in itself is not going to be critical, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But what will be, you know.
But it is for the media, because the media latches on to some player does well at. And then he becomes the media darling in the big draft.
From the fan perspective. Yeah, but unless you're the Hanshin Tigers and I think there are people in the Tigers office that says, well, we really wanted to draft player A, but the media is saying player B is better, so let's just take player A and hope he's around in the
not my point round. Not my point. My point is the media latching on and then the public latching on
Who cares? My point is, who cares? I mean, there's just noise. It's just noise. I mean,
the fans.
Yeah, and again, okay, I the fans deserve to make noise, and that's what they pay for. But again, it's irrelevant to what the teams think is best.
Right. And I'm just saying that there's a high-profile guy out there. He's on TV a lot. He gets a lot of interviews, and people want to know where he's going because they're fans. So
okay.
Tough.
Unfortunately, tough. But for the baseball teams, hard in a different way because they're not getting to see, there was no spring tournament for the scouts to evaluate some players. However, many of the regional tournaments will probably be going on in one form or another. Yesterday, the Nikon Sports contacted. I wrote about this on my blog, and 20 of the regional the prefectural federations said they were going to have a prefectural tournament, whether or not the national tournament goes ahead. So there will be baseball for the scouts, and that will be interesting. But my overall take on the effect of the coronavirus on the draft will be taking a very uncertain situation and making it more uncertain. Okay. So my guess, I'm inclined to think that it will be a boon for college and corporate league players who are more physically mature, at the age of 21, 20, 21, 22 than 17-year, guys they haven't seen since they were 17.
Right, so safer bet. So I would say, based on that opinion, that I would say that the draft might have more rounds than
I don't
we've
know.
Seen in more, because that leaves a lot of players, just a lot of unknowns out there. And so if I were a team, I would just want to scoop up as many players as I can sifting and seeing if I got anything in there.
Definitely a different approach than the major leagues, which is, this draft is costing us money. You minor leaguers are costing us money. In fact, you major leaguers are costing us money. So let's just get rid of the whole thing. Everything that costs us money is out. I think we're going to we could easily have a different approach because Japan's baseball culture is so different from MLB's. So MLB, it's like, coronavirus, how cool. Hey, we're going to, it's like they're going, Rob Manfred said, we're going to lose $4 billion this year. And you could practically hear some owners going, oh, goody. Because now we can really put the players in their place. We can go back to pre-free agency kind of totalitarian rule.
All right, we hit a button on Jim Allen that we got to hit pause. We got to find another button here. let's do this. Let's go to the notes and reveal the answers to your trivia question that you posed last week. How about that?
Yeah, I was going to put that. I was going to put that on the blog, but my blog. I crashed my blog the other day, so that precluded that. So I'll give you the answers here.
Hey, you know what they say? Don't drink and blog.
I did know that. And I wasn't drinking.
Don't crash your blog.
I was updating, and the updates fought it out. And when I refreshed the page, it was white. Okay, so the answer. So the question is: there are six players in Japan since the end of the Second World War, so from 1946 to the present, who have in their careers led their league at least once in the following categories: doubles, triples, home runs, and RBIs.
One of well them, said.
Yeah, about time. one is Carlos Ponce, our guest last week. And as I said on the podcast last week, that three are in the Hall of Fame. Okay, who are they? Okay, here we go. Number one.
Here we go.
Hanshin Tigers, pitcher and converted third baseman, Fumio Fujimura, Hall of Famer. Yomiuri Giants, pitcher and converted first baseman, Tetsuharu Kawakami, also a great manager. Yomiuri Giants, third baseman and Japan legend, Shigeo Nagashima.
Okay.
Hanshin Tigers, third baseman, Masayuki Kakefu. Soon to be in the Hall of Fame. He'll make it in a year or two. Carlos Ponce, and then the recent guy is Hiroki Kokubo, former Japan manager and third baseman. What you notice here is basically, with the exception of Kawakami, everybody was a third baseman at one
point. And weren't most of them right-handed hitters?
Left-hander, right-hander. Nagashima and Ponce and Kokubo are the right-handed hitters, and the other guys are lefties.
Oh, split down the middle.
Split down the middle, but basically third baseman. But anyway, so there's that. Hmm. So those guys, Kokubo is probably going to go into the Hall of Fame, so probably in 10 years, the only one not in the Hall of Fame will be Carlos Ponce.
Remember when we used to do trivia every week?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember why we stopped doing it.
Why we stopped doing it.
Too hard. But anyway, thank you all for playing.
All right. Let's go to fielding questions. All right. So picking up from Pete in Kansai, his Facebook post from last week, asking, I don't know if we're going to get around the infield. This was a really tough assignment, but we decided with our on-mic meeting last week to do first baseman, top defensive first baseman in MPV. And I got to admit, this was a struggle. I'm not going to lie.
Really? You were all in gung-ho like for the weekend on. I'm going, if I can find five, I'll be happy.
Because catchers, like I went on and went online and looked at UZR, and I went online and I looked at, I made my list first, okay? And then I went online and looked at these UZR numbers and the league's numbers and all these other things. And I just got to tell you, I didn't agree with some of the UZR stuff, but I guess since the issue with UZR is it just counts certain things. But yeah, it's not counting everything. It doesn't count making throws. And if a guy has really good hands, it just counts hard hit balls that are caught or not caught or something. I don't know what it counts. But so it was a really tough assignment. But I don't know. I don't know that I feel all that comfortable with what I've got, but I've got it. So you want to count backwards?
Count backwards?
I didn't have
what am I under? I got under anesthesia here. Okay. I had number 10. Now, there will be Pete, because we're only talking about 10s. So there are going to be some notable omissions. I have Ryuhei Matsuyama's 10, Hiroshima Kart.
Oh, yeah. No, you're not on my list.
Okay.
I got Jeffrey Marte from Hanshin, but that's just in a limited time. I don't know. He was just 10 because I couldn't remember if he played enough games that
I could have put him 10. I mean, I like him. And one of the things is, although he doesn't move like a third baseman where they were trying him out in this spring, he's got a third baseman's arm. He's got a pretty good gun.
Oh,
I think it's his speed is sort of what keeps him at first base.
Yeah. Okay. For me at 9, I've got Ginji Akaminai of Rakuten.
Oh, I've got Seiya Inoue.
Oh, I have him 8.
Okay.
I have him 8 on my
list. On 8, I have Hotaka Yamakawa.
See, now he had really, really great UZR numbers, but I just didn't see that. So my number 7 is Kotaro Kiyomiya, and I know you don't like him, but I actually think he has good hands, and he's a very good thrower of the ball. And from what I remember, making plays in the hole, mm-hmm. he's really good at. Maybe not so much down the line, but in the hole, you know, between first and second, he's good. So I just gave my 7. Did you give your 7?
No, Kazuma Okamoto, Yomiuri Giants.
Oh, Okamoto. Yeah, I have him a little bit higher on my list.
Okay.
All right, so who's your number 6?
Dion Viciedo, Chinichi Dragon.
Oh, huh. All right, my number 6 is Sho Nakata, and it's because, you know, he really has made himself a really decent first baseman. I remember he didn't have a position when he came out of high school, and they put him all over the place. But I think he really is best at first base, and he has really made himself into a good first baseman, in my opinion. All right, you're number 5.
Seiichi Uchikawa.
Huh. You know, his UZR numbers were, like, out of sight, but I don't think they're there now.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, but I think I like him. I still think he's a big former second baseman. I think he plays it fairly well. Nakamura is their favorite, but okay.
Okay. My number 5 is Kazuya Okamoto of Yomiuri. Okay. I think probably third base is probably where he's best suited, but he played them. He did well at first base, in my opinion. His numbers, UZR, and the errors, and I think the errors were really low, but and his fielding percentage was high. But still, I don't see the footwork, and there are other things that I didn't like about him at first. But okay. My number 4 was Hotaka Yamakawa of Seibu, and I thinking of what I see with the footwork, and he's a big guy, upper body wise.
But no, but he's got small, you know, he's got really good feet.
Yes. Yeah. His girth is upper body, but his lower body isn't that big considering what he's carrying around. So he does have the ability to move those feet around. And I think he's good with the glove as well. So I have him at number 4.
I have Sho Nakata at number 4. And I just think he's sort of the thing with Nakata is just the numbers over a period of years with Nippon Ham are just so strong.
Yes.
That I just can't resist. It's hard for me to can't resist putting him there. And also he's got a gun, which is, you know, nobody gets paid to play first base based on their arm.
That's true, because then my number 3 guy, I think I've joked about him when he's getting ready to throw. But I think it's important, yeah, because you've got to sometimes make that throw.
You got to make the throw across to third base. And
to third or to second. A lot more is to second when you're looking to trying to get a 3-6-3.
The 3-6-1 is probably more prevalent.
3-6-1 double play, yeah.
Cover home first base so well.
Yep. So my number 3 is Dion Viciedo, and the reason is he's a lot better than you think, except the throwing. And I do always joke that when he rears back to throw, I'm ducking even when I'm watching on TV.
Okay.
But everything else,
that makes me
feel better. He's better than you think.
Yeah.
He's better than you think. He's really good at stabbing line drives.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him through his time here get the line drives. He gets up really high. He grabs everything, sucks up everything in his area, especially the balls down the line. I've seen him make some of those diving plays toward the foul line. I think he's better than you think.
He's better than I think because I don't see him. I don't see him play a lot, so it's hard for me to rank him higher. So my number 3 is a guy who I have seen play a lot, who's Tomotaka Sakaguchi, who's basically a center fielder who's sort of like he would have been a first baseman playing for the Cebu Lions a couple of years ago when they were. It was Ihara It was when the Cebu Lions under Haruki Ihara, he was moving all the fast guys into like corner positions. He had fast outfielders playing first base on the position, you know, I don't know, it was bizarre. Anyway, so get off of that. But yeah, no, I like Tomotaka Sakaguchi. I think he's just so agile and quick, and he's got a good outfielder's arm at first base, which I think he's a terrible place to put him there because he's just underpowered. You know, if you're going to play first base, you want somebody who can be like a big offensive player. And Sakaguchi was a decent offensive player. He's a decent, okay. He's a
good right. payoff. All right, enough about a guy who's not on my list.
Okay. Exactly. I apologize for that.
Number two for you.
Ginji Akaminai.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I just don't think he has enough range. That's why I didn't put him up on a high. He's good at anything around him he's going to get, but you can get the ball past him, I think, easier. But that was my opinion of you know, seeing him play. My number two is Seiichi Uchikawa, SoftBank. And again, a guy who I think his UZR was the top, but I just don't think he plays enough. You know,
well, he was hurt last year. So, I mean, that's going to.
Yeah, he was hurt.
Yeah,
but he has been really good since moving over there. He's been really good. Like you talk about agility, good moving his feet. Brings an outfielder's arm to this position so he can throw across the field. He can throw plays at home. Really good, really good. So I was happy with that. So I think I know who your number one is.
Celestino.
I'm sorry?
Celestino.
I don't know what that means.
Jose Celestino Lopez.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he's not my number one as well. We saw some age appear in, because he had a long streak with no errors, and we saw a few errors from last year, but still the best.
I think by a step he's still the best. And when I finished my list, I moved Nakata up from 5 to 4 just because he's playing more than Uchikawa, and I don't see Vicieto play. So, but my top five list, I had basically four guys who were second basemen.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. A lot of these guys, like Vicieto, I've only ever seen him play first base.
Right.
Yamakawa, I think, they put him in the outfield at times, but I think mostly first base.
But Jose Lopez,
was a second baseman, yeah.
Akaminai has been a third baseman, second baseman, and the catcher. Sakaguchi I probably played second base since there's a thing in Japan where they like center field or second baseman.
Mm-hmm.
And
all right.
Uchikawa, so that's my list.
All right, so to continue our on-mic meetings here, we're going to do one next week.
Or sure, why not? Week? I mean, heck.
I'm sure, good. Why not? That's a lot.
Bother me.
Okay, so
we're going to do the third base next week a little bit, but we could just third base, sure.
Third base, all right. Third base for next week, all right. So the next question is an MP3, and it comes from our buddy Claudio in Toronto.
Hi, John and Jim. This is Claudio from Toronto. My question is this. If we get to a situation where we can only start playing in August or even September, would you rather play a 2-month-long season or write this year off and start fresh in 2021? The reason I'm asking this is because, personally, I wouldn't want to see a home run title winner with just 10 homers and a league champion with just 25 wins. I guess there needs to be a point of no return where, once passed, no baseball will be played this season. What are your thoughts about this? As always, congratulations on the show.
All right, Claudio, thanks a lot. Sounding good there on the MP3. And congratulations, my friend, to you too, for doing your show in Spanish, which I've never listened to because my Spanish is pretty bad. But sounds like a good question. Jim, what's your opinion on that?
Well, I'd be, you know, if they played a tournament season, I'd be happy. You know, they played, you know, the Central League teams will each play three home and away games against every team in the league and then pick one team to play in the Japan Series. Go for it. I mean, I'm not happy about it, but if that's the best they can do, that's the best they can do. The most important thing is they're safe. Mm. So I'm not, my main concern is that they're not, that the pitchers are fit. and the players are fit and nobody's getting hurt because they're lacking fitness.
Agreed. Agreed.
So if it's just to play, then no. But if they're fit and they can play 25 games or what, 30 game season, I'm good with that. And as for having a home run leaders less than 10, I think in Japanese baseball history, before 1946, Japan played with these lumpy, misshapen balls, and no batter ever hit more than 10 in a year.
In how many games?
100 or so, or 120. Wow. So as they say, excrement occurs.
Hashtag high heat.
And so,
excrement escapes.
It does indeed.
Yeah, that's a different problem. All right. Yeah. Well, I don't worry about...
Don't use your bare hands to catch that.
Wow. I don't worry about the sanctity of the record books because, you know, every year there has been no year in the history of any baseball league that has been exactly the same conditions. So they're just... Everything changes. So I don't worry about the record books per se. I know you have the number of games, and that's you know, kind of the standard. But obviously this year is different, and we just have to roll with the punches, and we are getting punched. So I'm not going to worry about that. As you probably realized through the years, I don't really focus on batting titles and home run crowns and all that. It's a good evaluation it's good data to use to evaluate, but it's not the end-all be-all for me or be-all end-all. The individual titles for me, they end up being targets for losing teams. And, you know, I'm not belittling them, but I mean, after falling short of the team goal, it's something that the team can focus on, getting a guy a stolen base record or hoping a guy hits a home run record or gets the RBI record. But those.
Well, certainly being out, playing meaningless games at the end of the season allows teams to intentionally walk opposing players and intentionally wild pitch and do all those other silly things.
Yeah, but if you're a winning team, that's just icing on the cake to get those individual titles. But if you're a losing team, it becomes the focus. So I think that's...
Losers!
So whether it's 10 jacks for a home run title or 25, I've never really worried about that. And none of that really matters when you have an asterisk on the entire season. So look at the flip side. If you could, you might have a pitcher who has a zero ERA and wins the ERA title, or a guy with a 1,000% winning percentage or something. Or you got a guy, conversely, Claudio, who hits over 400 for 2 months and he wins the batting title. So
It's something to talk about for sure.
Yeah, you might have some numbers that are deflated, but you might have some numbers that are inflated as well. So there's always the other side. And what about the Sawamura Award? I don't think we're going to have one this season. I haven't heard any talk about it, but you know, nobody's going to make any of the benchmarks. Are they going to try to reverse engineer what the
Sawamura? Yeah, that's a good. That's the question of the year. You know, what are these old guys going to say when? Well, we expect today's pitcher to throw 200 innings and be like us. And I remember back in the day when I used to practice 26 hours a day and sleep not at all.
Hashtag high heat.
Sleep is for losers and wimps.
Exactly.
So anyway, So I just hope they can get a season in if whatever the numbers are, they're all going to include an asterisk, including the entire season. So let's just play ball. That's all I'm hoping. John said with an asterisk. All right. Your voices are awesome. Thank you for the MP3, Claudio. Thank you for the question, Pete, the question that keeps giving. Anyone else who has a question, hit us up at YAKYUJOHN. @gmail.com, on Twitter @JBW Podcast, or on the Facebook page. The MP3s are awesome, as you can hear, so we accept those as well. Keep them under a minute. Thank you very much. Questions, comments, we're always looking for them. We need more. And even when baseball starts, I don't know that they're going to let us actually walk up and start talking to players as we have done in the past. We might have to just keep
are you kidding me? Now with my lisp, you know, they'd be saying like, man, stop. who brought the spray gun?
Yeah, I don't know how they're going and how many. They might start limiting the number of media members into that. Who knows what this post or it's not even post situation with the pandemic. We're still in the midst of it. So anyway, keep up the questions. We will talk to you next week. enjoy your lockdown.
Quarantine, baby.